Open with me to Leviticus 23. Leviticus chapter 23. The battery to the microphone is good and charged this morning, so I'll be able to wander for a good 2-hour sermon this morning, I reckon. So it's good to be with y'all this morning. This morning I'd like to finish up our series on worship. So the elders have in their strategic plan for the congregation set forth 6 areas where they would like for us to seek improvement as a collective here. And the first of which was worship. So what we've done the last few weeks is we've gone into both Old Testament and New Testament principles to try to figure out how can we improve our worship to God. What is worship? What does it mean to worship? And how can we certainly make our worship more pleasing to God? And so what we've done the last 3 weeks is we've really looked at worship on an individual basis. So in the book of Leviticus, as we looked at Leviticus 9 and contrasted that with Nadab and Abihu in Leviticus 10, we looked at how worship as an individual really relates to the commandments and the glories of God. And then the next week we looked at the cross, how the cross is the greatest burnt offering that's ever been given to God, and learned that true worship requires devoting yourself fully to God. And then last week in Romans 12:1, we recognized that true worship ultimately is sacrificing the self over to God. All 3 of these lessons, I hope, have been challenging to make us consider how we can devote ourselves more fully to God and individually make our worship more pleasing to Him. But what I'd like to do this morning is I would like for us to shift focus a little bit, and I would like for us to look at principles of collective worship. So the cross, Nadab and Abihu, Romans 12, all of those have related more to individual principles of worship. But I really want us to examine as a collective here, why do we worship? And even more so, how do we improve that worship? I mean, for many in my generation, and this may have been the generation before me as well, I don't know, but there's a large question. Why in the world do I need to go to church? Why can I not wake up on Sunday morning and have a worship service at home? That's a valid question that needs to be answered. You know, why do we as a collective need to be here to worship? Why can't I just worship in my building? That's a valid question that the Bible answers. But I want us to try to understand really why in God's wisdom, in God's providence, has He recommended that collectives come together to worship? And then likewise, how do we as a collective improve our worship to God? So again, what I would like for us to do is in review, true worship requires the individual to be devoted totally to God. And again, we could talk about this for weeks and weeks more. This is the central message of the gospel, that true worship and the true Christianity is really giving yourself over to God. It's sacrificing the flesh and its desires over to God and His spiritual nature. And then I'd like for us to answer the question, what does collective worship require? So let's begin in Leviticus 23. So what we've done so far in the book of Leviticus is we've really looked more at the sacrifices and offerings. And you'll remember with me that in Leviticus 1 through 7, God spells out very clearly in a lot of detail what all the different types of sacrifices were. There were sin offerings and burn offerings and guilt offerings and free will offerings and peace offerings and wave offerings. God had various offerings and sacrifices that the people gave to God as worship. But really, these were individual things. So if I sinned, I would bring my sin offering, and I'd bring it to the priest, and it would be killed and then put up on the altar. That would be something that would be done individually. But in the book of Leviticus, and particularly in chapter 23, he's going to talk about collective acts of worship. And this is what the Old Testament calls convocations. So while individuals presented sacrifices to God, God's also commanded collective assemblies. Let's read the first 4 verses. Leviticus 23, verse 1 down through verse 4. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "Speak to the people of Israel and say to them, these are the appointed feasts of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations." They were appointed feasts. 6 days shall work be done, but on the 7th day is a Sabbath of solemn rest, a holy convocation. You shall do no work. It is a Sabbath to the Lord in all your dwelling places. These are appointed feasts of the Lord, the holy convocations, which you shall proclaim at the time appointed for them. So not only did God have individual acts of worship that the people were to do, the sacrifices and offerings, but God also had collective acts that the people were to do together. And this is what he calls the convocations. Now, convocation isn't a word that we probably use that often. Purdue, when I was there, had convocations. And I never really learned what a convocation was at Purdue, but it was usually some really famous or powerful person coming and giving a talk that they charged out the wazoo for, and then we'd have a convocation and a question and answer, and then that was a convocation. They were the most boring things I ever went to in my entire life. I don't think that that's what an Old Testament convocation is. A convocation, the word is actually a bit difficult to trace, but it just means a rehearsal is actually what it means. And so what the people were doing is they were rehearing a lot of what had already happened, and they were coming together as a collective for this purpose. So a convocation was really just an assembly. It was an assembly for the purpose of worshiping God. And you'll notice a few facets of this. I want to bring out a couple of principles. But God says in verse 2, "These are my appointed feasts of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations." They are my appointed feasts. So the convocations that he's referring to here are really the feasts. And God spells out, it's interesting, if you go back to Leviticus 13 and 14, God has various food regulations in the book of Leviticus. A lot of those food regulations were so that the convocations of Israel, that is the feast, would be apart from the convocations of the pagans. God gave them food laws, so ultimately they wouldn't have holy feasts with the Canaanites, with the Amorites, and all the other ites that they took when they went into the land. God had, by his design of the law, given them particular foods and also had prohibited particular foods so that their feasts would be holy. But these convocations were a time where they came together. Now, two principles I want to bring out. First of all, these are holy convocations. So he says in verse 2, "These are the appointed feasts of the Lord that you shall proclaim as holy convocations. They are my appointed feast." Down to verse 3, "It is a holy convocation." Verse 4, "A holy convocation." Why are they holy? Because they are set apart for the purpose of God. So a feast could have just been them coming together and having social hour together. That wasn't the purpose of these feasts. The purpose of these feasts were so that the Israelites could come together and then worship God together and assemble together. So what God wanted them to do was to assemble. The second thing God was, these were appointed. You'll notice again, verse 2. These are the appointed feast. Verse 4. These are the appointed feast of the Lord, the holy convocations, which ye shall proclaim at the appointed time for them. These were appointed. These were set apart by God. God wanted his people to come together to worship him, to come together to consider him, to come together to remember him in a holy manner, but also in an appointed time when he told them. God wanted them to come together at an appointed time. And you know, I can already hear the Israelite complaints. God, if this is appointed, is it really that much of worship? I mean, if you're telling me year after year we have to come on the same days and the same times and worship you and have the same feast with the same people year after year, where's the spontaneity in this? I mean, if I want to come together and I want to have a feast, you know, why can't I just give it over to God? Perhaps would have been some complaints. Certainly are complaints today of church services. But God has appointed times for them that were to be holy. Appointed times of appointed feasts for an appointed people to serve an appointed God. God has these as holy. So when we look at the Old Testament feasts and the Old Testament convocations, God certainly had a collective aspect to this. And what he does in the rest of chapter 23 is he gives various convocations. He gives the Passover, the Feast of First Fruits, the Feast of Weeks, the Feast of Trumpets, and the Feast of Booths. These are all laid out. Now, what's interesting about this is there is one exception to this. These were feasts. These were time that they were to come together. Let me ask a question. How many days of the year did the Israelites have to fast? How many days of the year do the Old Testament people have to, by law of God, fast? The answer is one. There was only one day of the entire calendar year where God commanded them, you must fast on this day. Now, it was given as recommendation, you can. But there was only one that God had told them, this is an appointed day of fasting, and this is the Day of Atonement. So what I want to do is I want to use the Day of Atonement as an example and try to bring out a few differences. Now again, the Day of Atonement is set apart. On all the other feast days, they were eating. They were coming together, they were having bread. They were having various types of meat. They were reliving the Passover. They would have the lamb. They were feasts where they would come together, they would eat, and they would remember God, and they were holy. The Day of Atonement is going to be an exception. The Day of Atonement is going to set apart, and I want to bring out a couple points about this. So let's go ahead and read the section. Leviticus chapter 23, verse 26. Leviticus 23, verse 26. The Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now on the 10th day of the 7th month is the Day of Atonement. The 7th month was their holy month. Essentially, y'all, we can kind of think of it as our December. December isn't necessarily our holy month, but that's when everything happens. That's when you have Christmas. That's when you have New Year's. It's when you have all the festivities. It's when you have all different types of holidays. To the Jews, their holiday season would have been the 7th month. Okay, continuing on. It shall be for you a time of holy convocation. And you shall afflict yourselves and present a food offering to the Lord. Now, again, afflict yourselves, all that means is you're going to humble yourselves. It's not talking about physically afflict yourselves, but you shall humble yourselves. And then you shall not do any work on that day, for it is a day of atonement, to make atonement for you before the Lord your God. For whoever is not afflicted on that very day shall be cut off from his people. Whoever does any work on that very day, that person I will destroy from among his people. You shall not do any work. It is a statute forever throughout your generations and all your dwelling places. It shall be to you a Sabbath of solemn rest. You shall afflict yourselves on the 9th day of the month, beginning in the evening, from Sabbath to evening, you shall keep your Sabbath. So God spells out various more regulations in Leviticus 16, including the prohibition on eating in Leviticus 16. But he gives a summary of the Day of Atonement here in Leviticus 23. And again, I want us to note what the people are doing here. The people are coming together, okay? It is a time of holy convocation. So again, let's note, this Day of Atonement is holy. It is a holy convocation. You shall humble yourselves and present a food offering to the Lord, a burnt offering to the Lord. Do no work. Make atonement. Be humbled. If you do work, you'll be destroyed. Don't do work. It's a statute forever. It's a Sabbath. It's a rest. Humble yourselves. Y'all see a few patterns here. I mean, a couple things that he's telling them here is do no work. He repeats it over and over. And then he even goes so far as to say, if you do work on that day, that person I will destroy from among his people. Do no work and humble yourselves. Why is God telling them this? Do no work and humble yourselves. Don't be distracted by anything else. I want you to be totally and completely focused on me. This is the Day of Atonement, okay? And as I'll give you all a summary of Leviticus 16, the Day of Atonement was the day when the high priest goes into the Holy of Holies and he makes atonement. There's a sacrifice that's given that cleanses the altar, that cleanses Aaron, that cleanses his family, that then cleanses all the people. The people come together for a day of fasting. They do no work. They humble themselves so that they can be devoted on what this day means, the removal of sin from among their midst. God wants this day to be holy. And what God had appointed, not only the day, but the practices of it. God had made very specific specifications about what they were to do, when it was to be, what their attitude was to be. God had appointed everything for it. Now again, let's make a couple principles here. In Old Testament worship, first of all, God wanted his people to come together. The reason for these feasts was to bring the people together to remember various acts of God, and to remember various qualities of God. And on these days, as they looked to him, these days were to be holy, and they were to be appointed. And likewise, I think we're going to see in the New Testament these principles of coming together in a holy manner and in an appointed manner is going to be reissued in the New Testament. So what are our holy and appointed assemblies? We don't, as New Testament Christians, follow the Day of Atonement. I mean, one of our elders does not go in and we tie his ankles as he goes in and present an all sacrifice on the altar of God. I mean, that's not going to happen to Randy or Kirby or Randy in the seventh month. We're not going to do that. You know, we're not going to have Pentecost. We don't even have Passover. We don't even have the Sabbath. Feast of Booths, the Feast of Trumpets. We don't follow any of those. So what are the convocations that God now has for his people? Well, as we go to 1 Corinthians 14, Paul is going to spell out the New Testament convocation. 1 Corinthians chapter 14. There is actually, and this is a study that I would urge y'all to do in your own time at some point, there are relatively few passages in the New Testament that relate just to the collective assembly. As you go throughout the book of Acts, in a few different occasions, you do see collective assemblies, Acts 2, Acts 20, kind of Acts 6, kind of Acts 15, but relatively few. As you go throughout the writings of Paul, James 2, obviously it wasn't by Paul, but James 2 talks about the collective, 1 Corinthians 12 talks about the collective, 1 Corinthians 11 talks about the collective. But beyond that, what happens in the assembly, in the convocation, there's relatively little about. The vast majority of the rest of it relates to more everyday living. But 1 Corinthians 14, in my opinion, is the most direct passage of the New Testament that tells us the nature of our convocations. So let's begin in 1 Corinthians 14, verse 23. 1 Corinthians 14, 23. If, therefore, the whole church comes together and all speak in tongues, and outsiders or unbelievers enter, will they not say that you are out of your minds? But if all prophesy and an unbeliever or outsider enters, he is convicted by all. He is called to account by all. The secrets of the heart are disclosed, and so falling on his face, he will worship God and declare that God is really among you. What then, brothers? When you come together, each one has a hymn, a lesson, a revelation, a tongue, or an interpretation. Let all things be done for building up. Now, I want to pause here for a moment. Let's notice the context. When you come together, verse 26. When you come together, each one, etc. Let's go back to verse 23. If therefore the whole church comes together. Here in this context, he is talking about the whole church coming together. This is a convocation. The word convocation is not used in the New Testament. It's actually only used about 13 times in the Bible. Numbers 28 uses it a few times. Leviticus 23 has it more than any other times. It's never used in the New Testament. What we have in the New Testament is an assembly. We have an assembly, a convocation, where we come together. So when the whole church comes together, when you come together, what is this referring to? What we're doing now. And this, I think, is what Paul has in mind. The collective assembling of the saints for the purpose of worship. And this, I think, is our convocation that we have now. So, as in the Old Testament, they had their Feast of Weeks, their Feast of Booths, Feast of Trumpets, etc. We don't have those, but what we have is on the first day of the week, we have a convocation where we as God's people come together for the purpose of remembering God and for the purpose of praising God. Now, what are the principles that he's going to tease out? Now, let me give an introduction to the rest of this chapter first. What Paul is really dealing with in 1 Corinthians 12 through 1 Corinthians 14 is spiritual gifts. That's really his chief concern in those chapters. And so we don't have spiritual gifts today. We don't have speaking in tongues and prophesying. That's a lesson for another day. 1 Corinthians 13, I would recommend you to read. But the principles that he has here are principles that still stand today. So while we may not have spiritual gifts, the principles of worship that he offers are still principles that are binding to the New Testament church. So let's pick up in verse 27. If any speak in a tongue, let there be only two, or at most three, and each in turn, and let someone interpret. But if there is no one to interpret, let each of them keep silent in the church and speak to himself and to God. Let two or three prophets speak, and let the others weigh what is said. If a revelation is made to another sitting there, let the first be silent, for You can prophesy one by one so that you may all learn and be encouraged. And the spirits of God are subject to prophets, for God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. As in all the churches of the saints, the women should keep silent in the churches, for they are not permitted to speak, but should be in submission, as the law also says. If there's anything that they desire to learn, let them ask their husbands at home, for it is shameful for a woman to speak in church. Or was it from you that the word of God came? Are you the only ones it has reached? If anyone thinks he is a prophet or spiritual, he should acknowledge that the things I'm writing to you are a command of the Lord. If anyone does not recognize this, he is not recognized. So, my brothers, earnestly desire to prophesy, and do not forbid speaking in tongues, but all things should be done decently and in order. So here in this section, this is really the most direct section of the New Testament that deals with principles of collective convocations. Now, let's go back to our Old Testament principles. Old Testament feasts were to be holy, and they were to be appointed. How are our convocations today to be holy? Well, let's look at verse 25. At the end of the verse, it says, "The outsider will worship God and declare that God is really among you." Brethren, I think the greatest way in which our worship services and our assemblies and our convocations are holy is ultimately because God is among us. And this is something, brethren, we cannot fail to give enough thought to. What separates what we do here from what happens in other religions? What separates our assembly from a town hall meeting? What separates our convocations from a concert? The true difference and the true holiness is because God is among us. And brethren, this is what's at stake in collective worship. Is God is among us. Now let's think back to Nadab and Abihu. In Leviticus chapter 9, Moses told Aaron and then told the people, give these sacrifices so that God may be in your midst. God then comes down and he's in the midst of the people. The glory of God comes. It consumes the altar. It consumes the sacrifice. And God says, I was glorified. And then in Leviticus 10, Nadab and Abihu offer an uncommanded fire, an unauthorized fire before God. The glory of God comes down, and God's glory does not take the sacrifice, but it takes them. God's glory was among the people. And brethren, while we may not see the light and the glory and the pyrotechnics in the same manner, I would urge us to consider, just as God was among the people in Leviticus 9, God is among us today. And when we worship God, we are going before the God of heaven. When we worship God, we are going before the true almighty creator, the great, almighty, righteous, holy redeemer, the Savior. That's who is in our midst. And brethren, I'm not expecting that the lights are going to flicker and God's glory is going to come back from those back doors and that God's glory is going to come and come up to the altar. I don't expect that at all. But brethren, I think we have to recognize God's glory has been revealed in Jesus Christ, and it now dwells among the church. And whenever the church comes together, that holy temple of God, God's glory is among us. And if anybody of this world wants to truly see God, the closest we can ever come is what we do here on Sunday mornings and Sunday nights. Just think about that for a second. The closest, while I'm in the flesh, while I'm in a material body, the closest that I'm ever going to come to seeing God is in what a collective convocation does. And brethren, as we seek to improve and as we seek to make better our worship, God is among us. And that is the chief reason why our worship is holy. But just as Old Testament feasts were to be holy, they were to be appointed. And what God has likewise said, we need to have a collective that is commanded by God. And I think there's a few principles here that can help us to understand and determine what God desires of our convocations. The basic principle of these verses in verse 40, all things should be done decently and in order. All things should be done decently and in order. And to my knowledge, 1 Corinthians 14:40 is the most direct and explicit verse about principles of collective worship of the church anywhere in the New Testament. And if there's any principle that should guide our worship, if there's any principle that should guide what we should do, it's found in 1 Corinthians 14:40. All things should be done decently and in order. And as the elders here have laid out improvements and methods and strategies for improving our worship, this was the principle that was on their minds. How can we have a worship that's in more decency? How can we have a worship service that's in more order? And the bulletin this week, printed in there, is the list of 5 major changes that the elders discussed with the men last Sunday morning. And each of these relates to how can we have a more orderly and how can we have a more decent worship? But Ryan, seriously, are you telling me that God is concerned with order? I mean, can't I just worship however I wish? Can't I just come spontaneously before God? I mean, if Matt feels like jumping up and singing a song right now, can't Matt jump up and sing a song? If there's a psalm that comes to Randy's mind, can't Randy just stand up and start saying that psalm? And if Kirby is so overcome by thanksgiving to God that he wants to come and testify before God what all God has done for him, can't we just have all that right now? Brethren, let all things be done indecently and in order. Just remember, Nadab and Abihu messed up the decency and the order of sacrifice, and God took their life for it. And I don't underestimate the importance of this principle. If we as a collective desire to improve our worship to God, all things need to be done decently and in order. Why? Because, verse 33, God is not a God of confusion, but of peace. We serve a God, a monotheistic being, who is one, who is a God of order, who is a God of peace. And ultimately, we should have a worship service that is not of confusion, but of peace. Why does God desire our worship service to be orderly? Why does God desire our worship service be in decency? It goes to the very nature of God. And brethren, I'm afraid that whenever and I'll tell you, this is a desire, a temptation. When I desire spontaneous worship, when I desire worship that's not in order, whenever I desire that's not in decency, ultimately for me, it's a misunderstanding of the nature of God. For us to understand how to worship, we have to understand who we're worshiping. We are worshiping the God of Abraham. We're worshiping the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. We are worshiping the God who took the Israelites out of the Red Sea. We are worshiping the God who took Elijah and he brought him up to heaven. We are worshiping God who took the sacrifice of Nadab and Abihu and took their life. We are worshiping that God. And we are worshiping a God whose very nature is love, whose very nature is of peace, not of confusion. And for people to see God, they need to see the peace, the order, the decency that's in the service. For people to see God, because God is among us, it goes back to his nature. And ultimately, what's the outcome of this? Well, we look at verse 31, so that all may learn and all may be encouraged. Why don't Jessica and I just wake up at 11 o'clock on Sunday morning and have a Bible study and a prayer service and the Lord's Supper with just the two of us? I mean, that's a good question. And brethren, I don't want to underestimate that question. But why don't we do that? So that all may learn and all may be encouraged. God has designed his convocations in a way to where we are going to have encouragement from these. We are going to learn from these. We are going to be built up by these. God wants his people to come together for the outcomes of learning and encouragement. Now again, if we do things with order, we do things with decency, because of the nature of God, it will lead to learning and encouragement. And you'll look at verse 4. Earlier in the chapter, as he's discussing spiritual gifts again, he says, 1 Corinthians 14:4, the one who speaks in a tongue builds himself up, but the one who prophesies builds up the church. The reason that we come here together is to build one another up. The reason that we come here together is to worship the God of heaven. And when we worship him with decency and in order by his nature, it will result in the building up of this body. And that, brethren, is how God desires us to worship him as a collective. So what are the principles of worship? Over the last month, we've covered a lot. We've gone through a lot of the book of Leviticus. And I hope you've been impressed with just the magnificence of so many of the lessons in Leviticus. But also, as we've looked at their fulfillment in the New Testament, a few principles. Leviticus teaches us to focus on God's glory and to do as he commands. And then as we look at the cross teaches us to give ourselves to God. Romans teaches us to be devoted to God. And finally, 1 Corinthians 14 teaches us to be orderly and holy. So I want to finish by reading a passage from Leviticus chapter 22. Leviticus chapter 22. Right before God gives his instructions to Moses about the feast, I want us to note what he says. Leviticus chapter 22, beginning in verse 31. Leviticus 22, beginning in verse 31. So you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. And you shall not profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified among the people of Israel. I am the Lord who sanctifies you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. Brethren, as God speaks to the Manslick Road Church here in 2016, I think firmly he's telling us, you shall keep my commandments and do them. I am the Lord. You shall not profane my holy name, that I may be sanctified among the people of Israel. I am Yahweh who sanctifies you, who brought you out of the land of Egypt to be your God. I am the Lord. That is how we must come before the God of heaven in worship. That we will glorify him, that we will worship him, that we will praise him, because he is God. And so, brethren, how then shall we worship? We shall worship by his commands. We shall worship by total devotion. We shall worship by praise. And as a collective, we will worship in order, in decency, by holiness. Get out your songbooks, please. As I said a few moments ago, there is no time when we should be able to see God more clearly than in a collective worship. Because as we emulate his qualities, as we do his commands, as we follow what he has instructed, as we give ourselves to the pattern of Jesus Christ, God's nature, God's existence, and God's dwelling among his church should be so evident. And brethren, the question I have for us here this morning then is, who here wants to come to that holy God? Who wants to come to the God of Abraham, to the God of Moses, to the God of Aaron, to the God of Jesus? Who wants to come to that God? He is a holy God. He is a righteous God, and he is a God of peace. And the peace that can be found in God surpasses anything that this world can ever offer and anything that this world can comprehend. Because at his very nature, he is a God of love. He loves you. He wants your heart. He wants your life. Because he wants what's best for you. If anyone wants to come to the God, the Lord, this morning, come forward while we stand and while we sing.